So hi everyone. As said, and thanks Roger for the kind introduction and for inviting me to give this seminar. Okay, so basically, you know, I always found this cross section between computer science, or if you want more accurately, complexity theory, and physics, pretty fascinating. Hence, partially the machine learning side of what I do, but even just within physics, you know, you many times see that when you have like this intersection between a problem that's computationally interesting, that has a computational benefit to it, say like minimizing the energy of the Ising model, classical Ising model with some interesting disorder. So that turns out to be a very useful problem from a computer science perspective. You also get interesting physics. In that case, this physics of glassiness, all this replica, symmetry breaking, Parisi order parameter. So a lot of very beautiful analytical things. And similar things happen with the TQFTs or with quantum Hall effect and quantum computation. So when you try to, apparently there is a link between topological phases of matter, which have very beautiful mathematics, to the mathematics of error correction codes. It's almost the same thing, actually. And this is like a big part of physics, and it's also so fascinating probably because it has these links to universal quantum computation. So there is like a little corner in this well-explored area, which is the sine problem, which I'm going to talk about, and I'm going to present it, and I'm going to explain hopefully in detail what it is, when it's bad, when it's not, when it's intrinsic, when it's not. But this sine problem is typically considered a noiseless factor when you try to do your quantum Monte Carlo. So you have a microscopic Hamiltonian, you try to solve it using quantum Monte Carlo, and the sine problem creeps up, and you try to hit it in the head and somehow make it go away by clever tricks, by doing basis transformations. And usually people, as I said, try to get rid of the sine problem, but now there is like this little group of us that's asking, okay, hi, so there is a sine problem, it's there. Why did you come here? Why do you have to be here? Can you please go away? And all of these things turn out to have some interesting relations with gravitational anomalies and geometrical twists and topological data in the field theory that you're trying to simulate or you're trying to do numerics for. So I'm going to review some of the progress in this. It hasn't been too big, but it's sort of a recent topic. And these are my collaborators on this, Omri Golan from Weizmann, Adam Smith, who's in the Technical University of Munich now, and Dima Kovrazin, who is now in Clermont-Ferrand University in Paris. So we're going to start from the basics. It's not meant to be a very technical talk, at least I'll try not to make it one. Please ask questions if anything is not clear. It's much more, you know, I think good for everyone and fun for me when I get some feedback. So let's start with the basics. What is quantum Monte Carlo? I'll be short on this. How people define intrinsic sine problems? And what's the motivation, okay, for studying this? And then I'll go on with discussing how geometry, differential geometry, can be used to describe sine problem or as a strategy for establishing sine problems. Then I'll show our gold standard criterion right now, which encompasses all sine problems, intrinsic sine problems we know of, but it might not be the full criterion. And I'll then discuss some potential applications to actual models people care about in quantum Monte Carlo, or generally like frustrated magnets. Okay, so path integral quantum Monte Carlo. Quantum mechanics is hard, especially in the many-body settings, because we have many particles in a huge Hilbert space, and it's hard to deal with it on a computer. But also in classical mechanics, configuration space is very large, and we manage to deal with it in a computer by sampling from it using Monte Carlo. So path integral quantum Monte Carlo is a way to take us from this hard Hilbert space realm into the realm of classical probabilities, classical configuration spaces where we can use sort of off the shelf, say, Monte Carlo, classical Monte Carlo methods. And the way this is done, because quantum mechanics is not classical mechanics, the way this is done is through some quantum to classical mapping, where basically it's a beautiful idea, very algebraically basic, but it's pretty deep, that if you have a quantum d-dimensional system with Hilbert spaces and operators and all those quantum objects, it's equivalent to a quotation mark classical D plus one dimensional system, at least as long as you're interested in thermodynamic quantities. So let's see, why is that? So if we are looking to do thermodynamics, let's see now if this works. Do you guys see it's not what I wanted to do. Maybe this guy. Yeah, I'm guessing you're seeing it.
Yep, that looks good. Yeah, laser pointer.
So laser pointer, yeah. Laser pointer on. But let me shift the screen, otherwise I can't see what I'm doing. Okay, so we have a partition function, Z, which in the quantum context is the trace of e to the minus beta h. H here is an operator, the full-fledged thing. We do sort of a Trotter decomposition, where we now present it as a product over small enough, say, infinitesimal type steps, delta t. This is just an identity. Then typically you can divide H into two operators. Each of one is local and sort of commutes among itself. All its local parts commute, but both of these don't commute. So here you use the fact that you can do this Trotter decomposition, or use the Baker-Hausdorff lemma, and show that at least when delta t is small enough, you can present it in this way. And what you basically then do after you have this product with K and V, so K might be the kinetic part, V might be some potential part, and they don't commute. But now once you have this, what you do is you insert resolution of identity on some basis, which I'll call the computational basis. But on some basis, you insert here some big resolution of identity, which runs over, say, all the spin configurations of the system. And then you decide, then you look at this part and you can treat that as your Boltzmann weight, which depends on nearby configurations. So you ended up by inserting these resolutions of identity. Each such resolution is like now a sheet in time. You have many such sheets, basically beta divided by this delta t. And now you can write the partition function as a classical sum over all configuration space. This is basically a sum over all the basis elements in all the different time sheets that one has. And the Boltzmann weights, quotation marks, are just given by these matrix elements. And why am I saying quotation marks so often? It's because for a generic model, this thing would never be positive. Okay, it would be negative and it would also be complex. And then you have sort of classical Boltzmann distribution, but it has complex weights. And that is not really classical. That's already rich enough to describe quantum mechanics. So when we have that, we say we have a sign problem. We try to do quantum Monte Carlo one way or another. There are many ways of doing it, but often this sign problem is a stubborn little thing that creeps up. And okay, so eventually you take a log, you exponentiate things, and you have these energies. I forgot I had this piece. And then asking for this to be positive is basically asking for the energies to be real. So they can be positive and negative, but not complex. So that's a sign problem. You do that, you discover a sign problem, but that's not yet an intrinsic sign problem. What is an intrinsic sign problem? So we have now a diagram, a flow diagram, to that if you just follow, you know if you have an intrinsic sign problem. So you start from whatever Boltzmann weights you have coming from these overlaps between the time sheets, all this thing in the machinery of going from quantum to classical. So typically when delta t, you take delta t to be small enough such that you can drop this from the exponent. And then you ask yourself a question which is just directly almost related to the question of whether energies are real. You ask yourself, if I'm with bosons, are my non-diagonal matrix elements, in this basis that I've chose, are they all negative? If they're negative, that's good, because I have a minus sign here as well. And I only care about the non-diagonal ones. Why is that? Because the diagonal one can do whatever it likes. In any way, it's going to be subtracted from this big one here. And delta t, I remind you, is small, so he can do whatever he likes. But the off-diagonal ones, they don't get subtracted from the identity matrix here because it's zero on its off-diagonal, so they really control the sign. And unless they are negative, and also they cannot be complex, they really have to be just negative, zero numbers. If they don't obey this, well, then we have a sign problem, but not yet an intrinsic sign problem. We have complex energies. So we now ask ourselves, maybe there is a local basis transformation that cures this. You know, you can often find cases like that. For instance, this operator might be sigma x. And it happens to be that I wrote my Hamiltonian with plus sigma x in it instead of minus sigma x. But that's no big deal. I would just do some unitary rotation to make sigma x into minus sigma x, and I've cured my sign problem. So there are many cases where the sign problem is completely removable by a very trivial local transformation. You manage to do that, you don't have a sign problem. You have real energies, you have a Stat-Mech problem, and you can do efficient Monte Carlo sampling and use all the classical results. Say you did manage to find such unitary transformation, still this is not an intrinsic sign problem. Although some might already describe this as an intrinsic sign problem, I don't. I want to describe the sign problem as the most persistent object possible. This way it's sort of easier for me to show when it comes from why it has to be there. So then I also relax my criteria. I say, okay, so you chose a particular model to model a particular phase, but we don't really know if that's the right model. Maybe we're interested only in the low energy properties of this phase, and we can have many microscopic models, all just as good. So maybe there exists such a local S for a different model in the same phase of matter. So I'm looking for a D-wave superconductor, say. Okay, or I'm looking for some fractional quantum Hall phase, or whichever phase you like exploring. If that even doesn't work, then I would say I have an intrinsic sign problem, which due to some legacy terminology is now called here a hard sign problem, but it's like intrinsic, this might happen, because we sort of changed terminology in this more recent papers. Sorry about that. So I'm being pretty strict with what is an intrinsic sign problem. It's really a pretty severe thing, which is by definition not a property of the representation and not a property of any microscopic model, but rather by definition it's a property of a phase of matter, just the way we defined it. Any questions about this definition?
Hi, Zohar.
Yes.
I just want to make sure of something. So if you're dealing with gapped phases only, then this intermediate arrow on the left column would be unnecessary. Is that right? Like the existence of such a local S for a different model would imply for the given model.
Well, we still have universality even for non-gap phases. I mean, you can still have some several different microscopic model. I mean, you can still have irrelevant operators that you add to some critical theory, which keep it at exactly the same critical point. And so I do think that's something that's still relevant. It's true that it's more sensitive. I mean, you have to be more careful in how you change the microscopic model, because if you don't do it in some fine-tuned way, you might find yourself drifting off criticality and into a different phase of matter.
Yeah. But for gap phases, I guess you don't need this extra distinction. I mean,
for gapped phases.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's...
Is that true?
Gap phases, I can put a... If I have a finite depth quantum circuit, I can map myself. Well, it's a bit tricky. So you can map yourself from the ground state, of each model to each model, but with the local unitary transformation, you cannot map yourself from one model to another. It really holds at the level of ground states. Mm-hmm. But not all Hamiltonians are equivalent, right? Because by a unitary transformation never changes the spectrum of the Hamiltonian. So you're stuck with your excitation spectrum, that particular one. And maybe there is something lurking in this excitation spectrum that causes the sign problem. But you might be right. I'm just saying that it's not obvious that it is all you need. It's true that I don't know of any cases where, I mean, I'm not sure I need that as well. But I cannot prove that I don't.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, because unitary won't change the spectrum, so you cannot go from any age to any age that you want. And the sign problem is not just a property of the ground state. It's really a property of the partition function. So it allows you also to access excitations if you solve the sign problem. But I hopefully it answers your question. If there are any other questions, please.
Two questions.
Yes.
So the first one is when you go from, there is this local, S, such that you can basically, remove the sign problem, right?
But yeah.
How are you sure, when you go to no, how are you sure that there exists no unitary that can take away the sign problem?
Okay, so that's the nice thing that we want to show. That's exactly the point. There is a huge freedom to play with here. So how can you know that you can, that nobody, I certainly am not planning to go one by one over all possible transformations. So we would basically see that there are some physical effects which necessitate any partition function that's not real. And that would imply that we can never get positive Boltzmann weights because they would not give us these effects. But this is really, let's say, the bulk of the talk. This is really what we're trying to show.
I see. Then it comes to my second question. This is then based on the computational basis that you chose. It's like a basis dependent statement.
Right, right, yeah. That's true, but S already can map us between any two local bases. So by the way I see it is sort of putting aside the previous question, the way I see it is that allowing this local S would allow you anyway to go from any local basis to any local basis. So you can carry this statement now, if you've shown an intrinsic psi problem in one basis, because you anyway allow this freedom to have all S transformation, you already have this an intrinsic psi problem also in the other basis. So by this, I'm sort of modding out or exploring all possible local basis already, computational basis already.
Okay, thanks.
Great, thanks. Cool, so I'm calling it a sign problem, but why is that actually a problem? So one nice way to look at it is say we care about expectation value of some local operator O here, so we take its average with the energy E. So this is what it is by definition, classical stat mech. And the nice thing is that we can create some Monte Carlo process that basically flips configurations with some detailed balance condition. And then time averaging this creature here gives me this full ensemble average based on, if you want, the ergodic theorem up to corrections which are of that order. So it's, it decays as one of a square root of my computational cost, but still, it's nice. What happens with signs when I do have a sign problem? Then I should write my energy as a real part, as having a real part and a complex part. And one thing to maybe try and do then is to say, listen, let's just think about this guy here as part of the operator and average with the energies that we previously had. And then it's a little algebra to show that this amounts to averaging over these, having the ratio of these two averages. So now we don't have a sine problem in our Monte Carlo, but we have a sine full denominator. And the problem with this denominator is that, it's really defined as, so what I did here, if I want to make this into an equality, I've summed over everything e to the minus e, and here I summed over e to the minus e, and then all of this guy is this guy. So we have here a summation which includes phases, a macroscopic summation, like an exponentially large summation that includes phases, divided by the same summation which is coherent. And everything there is positive and simply adds up. This ratio is going to decay exponentially very, very fast. And how fast? Well, that's a question, but it's definitely going to be exponential with the volume. And so I'm basically trying to do a Monte Carlo sampling of a quantity that's exponentially close to zero. So to do that, I would have to take my n here to be exponentially large. And the rate of decay of this average here, this average defined by this denominator here, its rate of decay is often linked to the severity of the sign problem. So when people do Monte Carlo on the Hubbard model, this is what they suffer from. It's some temperature, which implies a volume in this d plus one dimensional space-time picture. They just have problems in sampling it with the fine enough accuracy. And the same happens, by the way, in QCD. This is by no means a problem limited to fermions, to condensed matter. Okay, so now I've basically talked about bosons so far, where I had this little trick using the Trotter decomposition to construct a D plus one partition function. What happens when we have fermions? We certainly care about this scenario, and it's a bit more tricky because we basically have no hope of making our path integral or making our partition function with all degrees of freedom positive. Because as you all probably know, when I have such partition functions, I have to integrate over bosons and fermions. And for fermions, there is this smart invention called Grassmann variables, but they are anti-commuting variables. So basically, it's very hard to represent them numerically or to sample from them. So all Monte Carlo methods we are aware of, maybe except Lefschetz thimbles, which I'm putting aside for the moment. What they basically do is they start from the full partition function, which you can still construct as I did before, but just with Grassmann variables on top of these, you have to put Grassmannian resolutions of identity as well and all of that. It's a bit technical, I won't go into that, but you can, it's more or less the same. But what you then do is you integrate over the fermions, and then you can often arrange it so such that the fermions are quadratic, and you get an integration over all your bosonic fields with a determinant that depends on the bosonic fields. And what we now want, so we treat this determinant, we take the log of that if you want, we put it in the exponent, and we treat it as some non-local energy of the boson field. It's basically somehow the interaction of the boson field as mediated by all the Grassmann variables, by all the fermionic fields. And we want that to be non-negative. That is, we want the log of that to be real. So the energy of this non-local, whatever interaction, would be real. So how do we ensure that? It has to be real for any choice of these fields. So there are many known design principle, which you can also read as this design principle, these guys here, which ensure that if you construct it properly, they make this determinant positive. Okay, or at least have a fixed sign, that's good enough. One of them is time reversal symmetry. Time reversal symmetry of this operator for any value of the fields ensures that eigenvalues come in pairs and you're okay. But there are many other methods far more general than that. So you typically want to ensure that this determinant is positive. How do we define an intrinsic psi problem now for bosons and for fermions? So for bosons, we can rephrase all that I said before as in one sentence. It's less constructive, but we say the following. An intrinsic sign problem for bosons means that none of the Hamiltonians in this phase of matter are stochastic. You have a phase of matter in some phase space with many parameters. Any point you pick there in this phase, sorry, in this phase of matter, would not be stochastic. Okay. So for fermions, how would I define it? I would say the same thing, more or less. None of the Hamiltonians in this phase of matter obey any of the known design principles. In particular, I can never generate a partition function such that this D of phi that I had before, this determinant, would have time reversal symmetry, but also many other techniques that people have found useful over the years.
So question.
Yeah.
So for the fermions, then you're saying this definition of intrinsic sign problem could change over time, basically?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes and no. Definitely yes, in the sense that I cannot prove that it wouldn't. Maybe someone would come with an ingenious trick to simulate all quantum phenomena. You know, we don't even know if quantum computation is truly superior to regular computation. It's just like a complexity theory assumption that, you know, we have good faith in. It stands in my mind at a similar level to these questions of whether P is different than NP. Maybe I'm giving it too much a bit, but we have, like, quantum Monte Carlo has been here since forever. Physicists were as smart, if not more, 40 or 50 years ago. And basically we have this pool of design principles that's more or less, you know, all quite simple local ideas, and none of them would say change the picture of this, of say the proof that I'm going to give. So none of them ever really, none of them managed to solve one of the hard problems for which I'm going to show that I have an intrinsic sign problem, and like say simulating the fractional quantum Hall effect. So, okay. But it is possible. It is possible that someone will come up with a nice idea, and of course that would be an amazing breakthrough. And I mean, also part of our motivation here is sort of to focus the efforts on these things to show what we think is possible with current techniques and what maybe requires other technique, and maybe give some guidelines to how these techniques should be created to avoid our proof. So now, it wouldn't be a very interesting question whether we have intrinsic sign problems if they're just, everything has an intrinsic sign problem and sort of just a miracle. So a lot of people, here are probably from Roger's group. So you know that you can solve the sign problem for many interesting cases, but a lot of people have the preconception that everything has a sign problem. You sort of have to be thankful that you find one instance that doesn't have a sign problem. And that's completely true if you're looking for random models and you look for a sign problem in that specific model. But intrinsic sign problems are different. It turns out that most of the phases of matter that we care about actually don't have a sign problem. So I made this little list. Fermi liquids. They're always to simulate Fermi liquids without sign problems. Interestingly, I recently heard from Erzberg that you can only avoid the sign problem in Fermi liquids that have a superconducting instability. And in other Fermi liquids, nobody has found a solution to the sign problem. But I would still say that generally there is no intrinsic sign problem there. Ferromagnets and antiferromagnets, you know, it's true, they break time reversal symmetry, but still you can solve the sign problem for them. Superconductor and superfluids, no problem. You know, attractive Hubbard model, that's fine. It doesn't have a sign problem. Topological insulators, in most cases, turns out that you can, you know, solve the sign problem and simulate topological insulators with weak or strong interactions. Many spin liquids, say the toricoat as a spin liquid, like Z2, just a simple Z2 spin liquid, and many other simple spin liquids don't have a sign problem. It turns out that bosonic SPTs, all these group cohomology model of Xiaogen Wen, all of these guys, all of them don't have a sign problem. All the group cohomology SPTs, it seems, don't have a sign problem and there is a computational basis which makes everything nice and real. Quantum Hall effect, that might surprise some of you. There are a quantum Hall effect with sigma xy, Hall conductance different than zero, that don't have a sign problem, the bosonic integer quantum Hall effect. They don't have thermal Hall conductance, but I'll get to that later. So we're left more or less with a lot of interesting fractional quantum Hall effects that do have a thermal Hall conductance, and Hubbard model and QCD, which probably have an intrinsic sign problem just by the fact that nobody managed to solve them yet, and frustrated magnets like the Kagome-Lattice ferromagnet. But it's actually more difficult. It's not, well, I would say there is a lot of, it's like a 50-50, I would say, or something of that sort, whether the quantum phenomena, the equilibrium quantum phenomena is sort of inherently quantum. There is no way to really even simulate it on the computer, or whether with some clever tricks you can find a local probabilistic model that simulates it properly. So again, in this motivation, I would just now like to tell you a bit about where it stands analytically. So there are a bunch of things kind of, I thought I heard a question. So what do we know actually about intrinsic side problems? So we don't know much. And now we know, I think, more, but let me tell you what was sort of the state of affairs before we started. So Hastings had a nice work from 2015, which went, I think, fairly unnoticed. And what he showed there is that some lattice gauge theory that can be written in terms of commuting projector has a sign problem. And I would not call it an intrinsic psi problem because he limited himself to commuting projectors. But he did give the flavor that this would have an intrinsic psi problem. It's just that his proof was sort of limited to having Hamiltonians which are commuting projectors. So this is a particular phase of matter. There are some complexity arguments that basically say, listen, if you would find a way to solve the sign problem, you would basically show that computational complexity classes collapse. There is basically, you would be able to simulate every quantum equilibrium phenomena, and that would eventually show that something that people don't think is possible from a complexity theory is possible. So these were more or less the analytical viewpoints on that. And so we're now going to delve into some of the details, but here are still some motivating questions, right? So just to recap, even if you sort of fell asleep or looked at Facebook at this time, are there phases of matter whose partition function admits no local probabilistic description? Okay, so do we have a classical explanation, at least for any given? We know, you know, from Bell's inequalities, we would never have an explanation, local probabilistic explanation for quantum mechanics, but now for a fixed phase of matter. Are there physically measurable effects that I can measure in the lab that will tell me that I have this intrinsic sign problem? All right, this is also something that we care about. Being a bit more ambitious, are there phases of matter in which a generic Hamiltonian instance is computationally hard? Not even for quantum Monte Carlo, but for any method. Okay, can it be a phase of matter that somehow is in a different computational class in the sense that you would never be able to solve most of the points in this phase of matter? And now something a bit more fun. Okay, no, that's not yet the fun part. This is still the scientific part. Can we, in principle, using available computational technology, simulate the world around us, right? And now here is where we got most attention for the first work we had with DEMA. It was not because of the science or the sign problem or anything smart we said there. It was because something DEMA wrote in our popular science summary that we sent to Oxford Press when he wrote it. And he kind of started by saying, well, we were trying to sell this story to PR, and it was a hard sell, you know, quantum Monte Carlo, a lot of details. So he had this idea of, you know, people don't really care about how you can simulate the world. What they actually care about is whether we are being simulated. This is something that apparently gets people's emotion on. So he started with this rough paragraph about, you know, people always wondered if we are actually simulated creatures or sort of real creatures. And then he said, you know, okay, here's a research that deals with the question of simulating nature and how hard it is. But anyway, it didn't matter. People read the first paragraph, and we were famous for a short while as the people who proved that we were not in a computer simulation. It was sort of embarrassing and sort of fun all at the same time. But let me, just to remind myself of these happy days, let me just tell you a bit how, why the surge came on. And this is also like, if you're a sort of a philosopher in disguise as a physicist, you might find this interesting. So it all came because I think Elon Musk recently read the simulation argument by Nick Bostrom from Oxford, and he posted that on Twitter that he believes that there is a 99% chance that we're part of a computer simulation. Here is why. And let me just cite Nick Bostrom here in his paragraph, because he says that beautifully. He says, one thing that later generations might do with their super powerful computers is run detailed simulations of their forebears or of people like their forebears, because their computers would be so powerful. They could run a great many sub-simulations. Suppose that that these simulated people are conscious, as they would be if simulations were sufficiently fine-grained, and if certain quite widely accepted position in the philosophy of the mind is correct, that it's all materialist. Then it could be the case that the vast majority of minds like ours do not belong to the original race, but rather to people simulated by advanced descendants of an original race. So we know that we are conscious. By this argument, if computers are all powerful, then most of the minds that are conscious are actually simulated. So if we're fair with ourselves, we have to say that we're simulated. So this is a very nice philosophical idea. I think, of course, we cannot say much, except that maybe we can limit a bit super powerful here. Very super powerful. Well, anyway, super powerful here. We can maybe use our arguments to argue with super powerful. But of course, a lot of people believe that quantum computers would emerge soon, and that would make our arguments irrelevant for the simulation, as a Cauchy argument for the simulation argument. So that's nice philosophical stuff. And now let's get back to business. I want to show you what's the geometrical view on the sign problem. And this is really, I think, you know, kind of the core of our contribution. This is really the thing we're doing various mileage on recently. So first thing to appreciate is that, you know, if you have a lattice, if you're a lattice person, you typically might not think of metrics and curvature and twists. But actually, a lot of lattice manipulations you can do generate these interesting differential geometry concepts. For instance, lattice inclination here, as I have it here, where I have a pentagon here, and all the other guys are squared, is a type of lattice defect that has this long-range effect. And one of the long-range effects here is that if you try to orient yourself, say, put your hand like this, and try to go with this orientation along the defect, you would find yourself rotated. That's exactly what curvature does. Here you have something that's, you basically took a cylinder and I glued it, and after sort of twisting it in this way, and that's a geometrical differential geometry effect that's called torsion. You think you went in a straight line, but you actually got displaced a bit to the side. Your angle might have stayed the same, but you got displaced. And here you, of course, add a boundary. So by twisting the lattice, you can introduce interesting metrics to your system. So that's one thing to bear in mind. So this is curvature, this is torsion, etc. The second thing I want to argue is that if you give me a lattice Hamiltonian, you tell me, you know, I solved the sine problem from some model, and you give me a local lattice Hamiltonian, you basically given me a Play-Doh to play with, okay, that I can now put on any geometry that I like. Okay, and I want to now explain how I do that. You've given me much more than a model, say, on a plane. You've basically given me a sine-free model that I can now put on a lot of very interesting geometries in a way that's sine-free. So that's what I want to gradually establish now. So say I have some model, maybe a bosonic model, where I care about stochasticity as a solution for the sine problem, and it's made out of various local terms, which I draw pictorially here on the lattice. So it has a link term, it maybe has a star term like that I draw as these little ghosts here. It has four terms in it, and maybe it has some other terms, but at some point it gets cut off. Okay, it's eventually it's local. Now I take my original lattice geometry and I put some global torsion, twist here. Basically I do this gluing twisted. I still know how to put the same Hamiltonian lattice geometry. There is really no question about it. Locally it looks like a plane. All my terms are local, so they cannot tell if they're on the plane or not. So I can put it on this geometry. So I know how to introduce global torsion to the system. And now I can solve, I can take my stochastic Hamiltonian and get a stochastic Hamiltonian on any geometry with torsion. But it gets better. I can also put curvature. It's a bit more subtle, but I can also do that. I can now have the same Hamiltonian be on this lattice. And again, in most places here, it looks locally as the plane. The only difference is in this region. Now I have chosen the range of my interactions such that even in this region, everything fits perfectly. So there are no doubts about it. Had I went further here and had like terms that cover 9 cells, then I would have some problem here. I would have some question about this 9-cell term here, what sites it actually deals with. So I would have some local arbitrariness, but I claim without proof that I can always resolve this local arbitrariness in a way that doesn't entail doesn't ruin my stochasticity. For instance, I would be able to polarize all this region and fix it to have all spin-ups if it's a spin system, and just turn off all other terms until I'm far enough away that locally it looks like a plane again. But this arbitrariness is a detail that I'm going to sort of overlook, which gave us a very hard time when we actually tried to prove things. I can also introduce boundaries. Similar thing, right? Now I would have this arbitrariness about how this little plus sign interacts with something here that doesn't exist. So one way to deal with it is to introduce fictitious degrees of freedom here that are polarized and then use the same term, but that's by no means the only choice. So you have arbitrariness, but this arbitrariness you can deal with in a way that respects your design principle or respects stochasticity in this problem. Okay, so the moral here is basically that I can change the metric using the lattice, but still have the same nice sign-free model. If the original one was stochastic, the one on the new metric would be stochastic as well, which is nice. What's even nicer though, is that it gives us a strategy now to prove intrinsic sign problems. And here's the strategy, which again, this is like the main point of all the talk, if you'd like. We start from some partition function and Boltzmann-Weitz, which are sign-free. And we know that specifically changing the metric is something we can do in many cases, all cases we ever encountered, in a way which is also sign-free. So the twisted partition function, the partition function on the twisted geometry, is also sign-free. Now it just happens to be that some field theories imply, and field theories basically tell you what phase of matter you're at, it happens to be that some field theories don't like to be twisted this way, or when they're twisted in this way, they throw out some phase in front of the partition function, some global phase. Okay, so they sort of have, if you want, an imaginary elastic response. Okay, so Z is like, log of Z is the free energy. So if I take the log here, I get the free energy after the twist, and this would be the free energy before the twist. The free energy gets an imaginary elastic response. Okay, and there is no way that we're gonna get that ever from a model. That in particular means that at least some of the Boltzmann weights here are not positive. Otherwise, how can it be that summing over all of them gave me a complex phase? So that means that there is a contradiction here, and that's really the mechanism we use to prove intrinsic sign problem. Geometry is special, it allows us to do modification in a sign-free manner, but field theory often tells us that we have this imaginary elastic response, and that's our tension, that's the tension we're riding on. So now we have to look at various phases of matter and ask what happens there. I assume I sort of have like 10 more minutes, Roger, would that be fair to assume?
Yeah, like I don't really have anything to do, so keep going. But people can drop off if they, we're recording this, so people can drop off if they
Okay, I'll try to keep it within the 15 minutes time frame then. Thanks.
Yeah, take your time.
So now I want to prove using this trick an intrinsic problem in the quantum Hall effect. Okay, so a quick reminder, what's the quantum Hall effect? We take a two-dimensional electron gas, some sandwich of materials that makes it quasi-two-dimensional. We put a strong perpendicular magnetic field. And the surprising thing that happens is that the whole conductance or resistance becomes quantized in rational factors of E squared over H, an amazing effect that won the Nobel Prize, maybe even several Nobel Prizes. And this is a very quantum effect. Maybe I should do more buildup here. It's called the quantum Hall effect. You measure E squared over H, H is the Planck constant, and things are actually quantized macroscopically. You measure some macroscopic observable, the conductance, which is quantized. There cannot be a more quantum effect than that by any sort of superficial definition. So it has to have an intrinsic sign problem, right? Well, it doesn't necessarily. Okay, which is something I find very neat and amazing. It turns out that if you take the quantum Hall effect on a lattice for bosons, so maybe a cold atom realization or something, and you put this amount of flux quantas, you get a phase of matter that has a whole conductance of 2E squared over H. It has a whole conductance, right? It's quantized everything, but there is a sign-free description of that. Okay, so this is really in this series of works that's been worked out mainly by, I guess, these two guys and Gerard and Montunich, who actually found a way of simulating that with some coupled superconductors and going to the phase representation in one superconductor and one superfluid. Very nice thing. Hard paper to read, but very nice. This specific quantum Hall effect, there are many of them, exhibits quantized Hall conductance. It has something even called the U1 charge anomaly on the edge, just to make it sound even more quantum. It doesn't exhibit what's known as a thermal Hall conductance. And it's, of course, not one of these quantum Hall effects that enables you to do universal quantum computation, but not all of them have a sign problem. So now we want to find out a transformation. Like I told you that the geometrical transformation are really the core of every proof that we have. So I want to find a geometric transformation that will sort of expose these signs in the partition function, make them sort of come out in this factor here that I like. So we have a space-time picture here. Let's just feel okay with it. We have here the x-axis and the y-axis. Okay, so this is my space. And we basically have here, this axis is open. So here on this space-time plane, we have a chiral boson because it's one end of the quantum Hall effect system. Here we have an anti-chiral boson, 1D particle that goes the other way around. And these chiral bosons, they carry a lot of momentum. And momentum is something that I probe using translations. Fortunately, they carry the exactly opposite momentum. So if I just translate both of them, the momentum would eventually cancel, or at least I won't have anything intelligent to say about it. So what we do this partial translation. We basically take half of the system from the bulk of the system, which is gapped, say from the middle, to the right part, we displace it. Here we don't displace it. Sort of something to get used to. So we are basically acting with a translation operator very nicely on the chiral boson. We're doing some slight mess here, but very fine mess because locally nothing is really happening and it's a gapped system here on the inside. We are doing something a bit more nasty here where we're inserting a screw dislocation if I have a lattice system. And here we're not doing anything. So now this allows us then to show that basically what we're gaining here is the momentum of the chiral boson plus some sort of trivial contribution from the screw dislocation, which basically amounts to this phase factor. So alpha here is an extensive contribution coming up from all the contribution of all the chiral bosons here, each one of them giving momenta. There are many of them, as much as this is long, so I have here an extensive contribution. And alpha is some non-generic number that also gets maybe some contributions from this guy here. The interesting thing is this guy here that also has a famous name. It's a gravitational anomaly. If you want, it's a Casimir correction for the momentum. It goes as 1 over the length of this box. And this is already nice because it already has topological information in it. What you have here is, if it's a fractional quantum hole, you have here the topological spin of the ground state, and you have here the central charge lurking up. And then you have other subleading corrections, so O of nx minus 2 that you can remove by choosing a big geometry. Now, this phase is by no means always, this might be zero for some choices of nx, but you can show that it cannot be zero for all choices of nx. Okay, so by doing this twist, if this guy is not zero, we can show that there must be a complex phase here coming from the gravitational anomaly and hence a sine problem. So we made some extensive checks.
I want to make sure, can you go back?
Sure.
I want to make sure what's the setup here. So in the slide previous to this one, you were talking about bosonic integer quantum hole where the boson is not Carroll. Here, are you switching to another setup with the Carroll boson?
Oh yeah, if it's not Carroll, then my criteria won't be interesting. For instance, it works for all of them. It tells you when there is, so let's take exactly the bosonic integer quantum hole effect. So it's an integer quantum hole effect. You don't have any interesting topological spins here. Okay, so I can forget about H naught, it would be zero. And it turns out not to have a central charge. It's kind of interesting because it has a whole conductance, but it has two branches, it has two counter-propagating branches. One carries charge, the other doesn't.
Okay, so the C appearing in this expression is the chiral central charge.
Is the chiral central charge, yeah.
And the H naught is, what is H naught?
H naught is the topological spin of the ground state. So if you have a fractional quantum hole effect, I didn't go into that, and I prefer to stay away from that because it's a short talk. But if you have the fractional quantum hole effect, you have many ground states, okay? And when you have a geometry with an edge, that reflects that you have many topological sectors in your CFT. So we have some primary fields in the CFT which correspond to the topological quasi-particles in the bulk. They have a topological spin, and that messes up. With the chiral central charge. So there can be instances where chiral central charge is non-zero, but the topological spins makes it vanish.
So H0 is the topological spin of which?
On the ground state that you're working in. You basically have to sum, in the partition function, you would have to sum over all of them. But say you somehow fix the topological sector. You know that the ground state here has a unique H naught. Okay, because of some microscopic consideration, it picks up one. There would typically be a single ground state, and so that would be some random microscopic choice made by the lattice model that you cannot control. So you have to assume H0 is arbitrary. But it still comes up from some discrete set, so that's not too bad.
Okay, so can I say H naught is the topological spin of whatever anion that happens to be trapped in the system?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Then in order for this phase factor to be trivial, I need to have some special nx. And I guess for some choices of the theory where H naught and C take some particular values, there may not be any nx where the
phase. No, but that's fine. I mean, I just want to say that it's enough for me to say because I have a freedom to choose nx. Right, I can always add in my simulation another site. I can always consider a bigger system. It's enough for me to show that there exists a single NX for which this guy is non-zero, and that, or not a multiple of 2 pi. And that's enough for me. And you're right, there might be that it's non-zero for any. It might be that alpha is, say, irrational. These things typically come out rational. So it might be that alpha is irrational and you will never get anything. But we don't assume that. We assume that alpha might be rational, and worse, it might be that H naught changes as a function of nx. And that could be. We have cases where that happens, actually. Mm-hmm. It's a bit more subtle, of course, than what I'm showing. I mean, Adam Enomri slaved on this for 2 years for good reason, because there are so many subtleties in this thing. If you really want to make it from an argument into a proof, there is a huge amount of subtleties, and we had ups and downs until we thought that we're going to scrap everything. But I think that we had finally had it under very good control.
Mm-hmm. So suppose I just take nx to be the value where this phase factor is trivial and do the simulation in that case, what will I find?
Well, it won't help you, because basically if you do the simulation, it means you told me that you found a local Hamiltonian, okay, that's, say, stochastic. But then I can take your Hamiltonian and just add to it another layer and have a different nx, and that would be in contradiction now, because for the larger nx, I know I should have a phase factor, but there was no phase factor to begin with, so how did I get that?
But suppose I have an infinite set of nx such that the phase factor is trivial, then can I take thermodynamic need in this way?
Right, I still have the freedom to take whatever nx you give me and add one layer, right? So you tell me for this nx, if you found some non-local Hamiltonian, I don't have anything to say about it. But say you do the more reasonable thing and you tell me you find a local Hamiltonian, I have the freedom of changing nx, and the promise that it's stochastic must remain true for nx, nx plus one, nx plus two. It doesn't change it. So you see, so it doesn't really matter if you find a particular nx where there is no sign problem. Because it comes from a local behavior of the Hamiltonian, I have the freedom to change nx in my argument and show and expose the signs that you have there.
Do you mean then suppose I change nx to nx plus one?
Yeah.
Actually, I still don't understand. Just this particular question, suppose I have an infinite set of nx that goes to infinity, such that this phase factor is trivial for this infinite set of nx. Then I just take thermodynamic limit using this set of nx. Is that bad?
That's great for you, but I claim that this is impossible if you could do that. Because here is what you give me one nx that you like. Maybe it's 1001. Okay. Mm-hmm. Then you tell me I solved my local stochastic Hamiltonian. I have a local stochastic Hamiltonian that remarkably doesn't show any sign here when nx is 1001. I say fine. Give me your stochastic Hamiltonian. Okay, I'm now going to explore it, but I'm going to put it in a system whose geometry is 1002. I can still do that. And because the Hamiltonian is stochastic, I'm still assured that I could not have any phases in the partition function. But here they are.
That okay? is to say it's impossible to have that infinite set of nx?
Yeah. Well, no, it's not to mean that it's impossible. It means that you didn't find a stochastic Hamiltonian. It's possible to have them, but it doesn't come from a stochastic Hamiltonian. And what you actually need for simulation is not that this phase would be zero. It's the fact that you would have a stochastic Hamiltonian. So the fact that even for a single nx, this is not zero already forbids stochastic Hamiltonian, which is the thing you care about when you try to simulate bosons.
Okay, I see. Thanks.
Great. Okay, but that's a very good question. So we have some big table here of tons of fractional quantum Hall effects or related topological theories where we use this criteria and found out when do we have a sign problem. In some cases, surprisingly, there is like a small portion of things that don't have a sign problem, but it's probably because Well, I don't know. Maybe it's because our criteria isn't tight enough. Maybe it's because there is some magic to do here. So Omri was very diligent and did this nice table. So you do find some Laughlin states from the first 1,000. You find a few 10 or 20 that don't have a sign problem. Maybe it's worthwhile looking if they have a stochastic description. But I don't know. I wouldn't count on it. Then, I'm going to be a bit more brief on this. We now, this is a chiral theory. You can say, you know, everything here smells so non-time reversal invariant, it's sort of trivial, but now we actually have a machinery that also works for non-chiral theories and non-chiral TQFTs. Some of these are, say, if you heard about the Torrey code, the double semin model, string net models, These all at their low energy correspond to non-chiral topological quantum field theories. And what are these TQFTs? So one definition is that it's a field theory which is metric independent. Another definition is that it's a field theory that somehow magically creates an association between 2D surfaces and vector spaces. For instance, when you put it on a torus, it gives you the vector space, which are the 4 ground states, say, or the n ground states that you might have in the system. For the toric code, it say it's 4, and for the double semen, it's 4 matrix. But then you put it on a system with a different genus, it generates a different vector space. And when you have like this cobordism, basically 2 surfaces which you connect by a manifold, it gives you a unitary transformation. So these are very interesting models, closely related to topological, to quantum computation and to quantum error correction codes. And one very important object there that almost classifies them completely is their T-matrix. Basically, the idea is you start from a particular ground state of these things on a torus, you act with the T-matrix, and it sort of does a den twist to everything there. Then you can start asking how I got a ground state, one of them, I twisted it, and now I take the overlap with what it was before, say, or with a different ground state, that gives me a matrix, which is the T-matrix. And we like the T-matrix. Why? Because it's really geometrical in its definition. So there is hope that we can generate some geometrical twist to our lattice that calculates the T-matrix. And if we can do that without introducing signs, then we have some assurance that the T-matrix has some positivity requirement, and that's already a constraint that we can start to work against and see which TQFTs obey or not this constraint. So I'm gonna be on the sketchy side here, although the details here clearly matter. So we have a lattice implementation, if you want a kind of a lattice protocol to calculate numerically the T-matrix. It's not something I would use in practice, but it's something that allows us to ensure that whatever manipulation we're doing to the lattice, everything remains positive. It involves inserting various defects, dragging them around, and a lot of details that are too late in the talk to go into. But here's the main criteria that we have. And that may be a nice piece of logic you guys might want to follow. Let's think about bosons. For bosons, ground state degeneracy and stochasticity all imply, by the Frobenius-Perron theorem, that all ground states are positive. That is, there are some of positive amplitudes on the computational basis. Now, our implementation of the T-matrix of the den twist, I didn't prove that to you, but I also argued that we can do it in a way that doesn't introduce signs. That means that the T-matrix calculated on that basis, on the basis on which the Hamiltonian is stochastic, is actually element-wise non-negative. But that's a very hard thing for a unitary matrix to be. Okay, so the T-matrix, basically because it's an overlap between positive ground states and some positive matrix in the middle that induces the den twist, it's all this positive creature. But it's also a unitary matrix. And it turns out that the only unitary matrix you can have, it's very simple proof, which Adam picked up, and that was really a breakthrough here, that element-wise, positive or non-negative unitary matrix is simply a permutation matrix. Okay, that's like a mathematical lemma. And now permutation matrices have some interesting spectral signatures. For instance, they can always be decomposed into these cycluses, and so all their eigenvalues come in full sets of roots of identity. Okay, now, eigenvalues are not dependent on the presentation of the T-matrix. Okay, so that means that the spectrum of the T-matrix, that's a quantity that I can calculate in any basis, must consist of full sets of roots of identity. And nicely enough, the eigenvalues of the T-matrix bear a very clear meaning. They are the exchange statistics of the particles. So we get to our criteria, which is that the exchange statistics of the particles have to form full sets of roots of identity. Okay, so let me give you some examples. So so the toric code has...
I'm sorry. I just to make sure something?
Sure, yeah.
In the previous slide? Yeah, thanks.
Yeah.
So in the second line, when you said the ground state degeneracy and the stochasticity imply all ground states are positive, what does it mean? I guess I missed what does it mean to say
it means that say you have four ground states like in the Tory code, when you write them, they look like a sum of positive amplitudes plus the basis elements. But they're a wave vector whose amplitude is always positive or at least not negative.
Okay, so there exists a basis, a good, a nice looking basis such that the wave functions.
This is the basis on which you're stochastic.
Mm-hmm.
So on the basis you're stochastic, Frobenius-Perron tells you that if you have a degeneracy in the ground state, that implies that all ground states are positive.
Mm.
And it implies all the other nice properties of these guys, but yeah.
Uh-huh. And when you say the spectrum of the T matrix gives the exchange statistics, do you mean it gives the topological spin?
Yeah.
Okay. And the full set of roots meaning what?
Well, so a full set would be something that like all the roots, all the nth roots of say minus one. Okay. So well, maybe I can show it with the example saying the double Semyon model, you don't have a full set, right? Because how would you divide it into a full set? So you have one and I, so you want to have minus I, but you also need to have minus one then, because I can take now the square of that and get minus one, so I don't have your full set of roots of identity.
Okay.
So that's the double Semyon model. And indeed, Hastings also thinks that it has an intrinsic sign problem. But our proof doesn't rely on commuting projectors. And so we think it really implies a property of the phase of matter, but definitely a lot of credit goes to Hastings. And so we have a much more though comprehensive criteria. So it applies say for the Tory code. So with the Tory code, you can think about this as one full set of roots of identity. This is another full set of roots of identity. And these two are another full set of roots of identity. And indeed, you know, we know how to do quantum Monte Carlo for the Tory code, and stochastic Hamiltonians are well known. Interestingly, this also applies back to the fractional quantum Hall effect, although we talked about non-chiral phases here and we don't have fermions yet, but it's still nice to see that the same things, we get the same information. So with the fractional quantum Hall effect, it turns out that the T matrix looks like that, and this guy is really this e to the I 2 pi h a, and we actually come back to the same criteria we had before, because if none of these is one, then I definitely don't have full sets of roots of identity. So it really, this criteria of this exchange statistics criteria really encompasses all examples of intrinsic sign problems we know of. So that was like the main point. There is some hand-wavy extension to the Kagome antiferromagnet, which is an actual model that people wanted to solve. Maybe it's worth mentioning. It's hand-wavy, but it's still interesting. Basically, the statement is that, the Kagome lattice has long been thought to host a chiral spin liquid. Then it turned out it doesn't. But people thought that it might, which means that it has some microscopic signatures of being in the vicinity of this chiral spin liquid. So it turns out that there are some ways, say, to tweak its parameters where you now actually get a bona fide chiral spin liquid. Now, a chiral spin liquid is basically a fractional quantum Hall effect, which has a sign problem. So we conjecture that the Kagome antiferromagnet might be getting a sign problem by being in the vicinity of an intrinsic sign problem. So on small scale, at least, he doesn't know which phase it's going to fall to. So that gives you that. I know I'm really pushing your attention. So let me just finish with the outlook, because I think, you know, like a lot of, you know, research, maybe the more interesting thing is what else can you ask, right? So I think it's very far from being something closed or that we reach the end of the road here. I think there are a lot of fascinating questions, and I'd like to go over them quickly. One trivial one is, okay, we talked about this geometrical angular sign problems. Is it this the only thing? I mean, is this really the source of a intrinsic sign problem? I guess most likely not. But I wonder what other principles might lead to that. Can we detect a sign problem numerically at some lower computational cost than solving the model? Using the exchange statistic criteria, we know that if you do a extensive numerics that actually gives you all the topological spins, you know you have a sign problem. But then arguably you don't even care if you have a sign problem because you already solved the system So, you know, it's nice to know, but you somehow managed to solve it anyway. So is there some simpler way to detect sign problems numerically? Say we can engineer a model in the double semion phase and maybe sample a bunch of models in some vicinity of that model. Is that a proof of quantum supremacy? We don't know of an algorithm that can simulate this thing. Okay, so is that something that we can now go to Google and say, you know, please give us, you know, funds and all of that, because we are real quantum supremacy people now. Something I find very interesting, like from borrowing the idea of oracles from complexity theory, say you actually had a device like a GPU, like a double semion Monte Carlo sampler that you would just somehow miraculously plug into your computer and that would sample randomly any operator you like from the double semion model. So you solve that problem by having this physical oracle that does that to you. Does it help you do Monte Carlo for other things? Or maybe it just opens a small environment of TQFTs, the ones that are not universal for quantum computation. So there are a bunch of complexity classes that one can start structuring by assuming you solve the sign problem for a model, we have some oracle for that. What does it imply on algorithms for the other guys? Last but not least, we are completely avoiding here the question of how severe is the sign problem, which is a very important question in practice. If this, even if you have a sign problem, but it's some minute effect that has a very weak decay, we can be very happy with simulating QCD on a lattice of size, you know, 1,000 on 1,000 on 1,000. Then most questions about QCD would be solved. We might get this Nobel Prize for this $1 million for confinement prize that people are mentioning. I don't know if it's a legend or not. So can we somehow bound the severity? That's something that's practically very, very interesting. Great, okay, thank you for your attention. Sorry that this has been long, but Roger hasn't stopped me, so I'll put the blame on him, and yeah, I'm done.
Absolutely, thanks, Zohar. We've had some questions, but let's have a couple more, and then we can shut the recording off. Any questions from the audience?
Can I ask a question?
Hi, Zohar. So can I ask a question? So in previous slides, you mentioned this chiral-spin liquid. So actually, it is spontaneous break time reversal symmetry.
Yeah.
So does your proof also like show this type of phase also has intrinsic side problem?
So this does complicate things a lot. Okay, but we think we managed to prove that as well. I won't go to the technicality of this, partially because I don't remember them well enough to answer this, but it does appear in our paper with Omri, who has worked hard on this. We have some construction where we basically generate, we call it the bagpipe construction, we basically generate many surfaces and somehow, so basically once you have spontaneous symmetry breaking, the partition function looks like a sum of the two sectors. And instead of getting a phase, you're getting some cosine terms. The cosines can still be negative, which is good enough. I don't need complex numbers. Negative is good enough. But then it's harder to argue that you can get these negative numbers, and we have some twist on that. But it's a good question. But yes, we think that we proved that as well.
Okay, yeah, thanks.
So to make sure, so you mean within the model on this slide, the model cannot be simulated by Monte Carlo without sign problem?
The Kagome lattice antiferromagnet?
Uh-huh.
Well, here is the dodgy part, and this is why I say that this part is hand wavy. The Kagome lattice itself, people think now it's a Z2 spin liquid. That's as far as I know, kind of what's right now believed. So the field theory governing it doesn't have this behavior where you get chiral central charge and you have like these topological spins that are interesting. It's something pretty mundane, like the Torrey code, which does have a solution. So that's a problem in our argument. The field theory here is not really intrinsic sign problem, but it is true that we're in the vicinity probably of such a theory. And just from a physicist's point of view, it's sort of hard to believe that a Hamiltonian that can be tweaked by some finely chosen perturbation to a phase with an intrinsic sign problem suddenly doesn't have an intrinsic side problem because you remove this little thing.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how little is this thing. There might be even some pathologies I'm not aware of, even if it is a like infinitesimal perturbation. So that's why I say it's handling.
Mm-hmm. There's also some statement saying this kagome lattice hosts a dark spin liquid.
Sorry, a what?
A dark spin liquid.
A dark spin liquid, right, yeah.
What statement can you make for that?
Yeah, that's hard for me to deal with because all our proofs eventually assume, for instance, in this part where we have to sort of start gluing the lattice by introducing defects, we assume that by acting as you would in a gapped system, that by acting for quite a short time with the Hamiltonian, we can project back to the ground state in a sufficiently quick manner to bound all sorts of errors. If it would be a gapless system, I would have a harder time showing that. I'm not saying it's impossible. We actually haven't considered that. It's definitely worth thinking about, but it does, our proof doesn't apply for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it sounds very cool. Thanks.
Yeah, actually, we know that Dirac spin liquid can be simulated using Monte Carlo, like all those lattice QCD guys are doing these simulations for decades.
I see. Right, okay. Actually,
a more general criteria for a generic CFT can be developed.
Actually, Yinchen, are you sure on the Kagome lattice that QED or QCD lattice theory doesn't come with a sign problem?
I personally don't know what you're talking about. So I mean, I'm aware of that. I think Snir Gazit, actually, next door here in the Hebrew University, had some ideas about how you create this Dirac semimetal. Is that related to what you guys are talking about? That I know is sign-free, but yeah, I have to say I've placed most of my focus on gap systems where I have better analytical control of proofs, et cetera, and things like that. But if anybody wants to talk about this later on, I would be happy to hear and learn.
Actually, can I ask another question?
Sure.
Am I correct to say that the proof you had requires translation symmetry of some sort? Because otherwise, I don't know how to define notions like lattice defect or momentum.
Yeah, no, that's a fair choice, but that's a fair statement. It's true. If something is, say, quasi-periodic or strongly disordered, then we cannot make proofs. But, I mean, if you give me anything that's periodic with some period, right? So basically, just stay away from disordered systems and quasi-periodic systems, then everything applies just with a larger unit cell because I never really, right? And then it's sort of hard to imagine that disorder would change that. We actually thought for a while to start doing some replica calculation and show how do things behave in a replicated partition function, maybe do something with that. We haven't followed that up. I think that's something. And if it can come in a quasi-periodic system, you know, that would be amazing. But yeah, but we haven't disproven these kind of things. I agree. Yeah, that there's definitely some opening there.
I see. Thanks.
Zohar, I had a question.
Yes.
So far you are considering defects of lattice, essentially, right? Various torsion and dislocations, yeah, and so on. Does the statement also go through of having a sign problem if I create defect related to a symmetry? I don't know, some symmetry defect. For example, I apply some symmetry operation only in some part of the system.
Yeah, so that's a very good question. So it really comes... So let me answer you with this example that I had here. So this thing has a charge anomaly on the edges. And as you probably know, because you asked this, you can detect a charge anomaly as this global phase in the partition function if you put a Aronov Bohm flux, which you can exactly implement as this line sort of defect where you switch the phase. The point is, and that's where the geometric part enters, is that we want to be agnostic to the local basis. And how such a symmetry-related operation would behave would be very, very basis-dependent. In some nice choices of basis, it might not interfere with stochasticity at all. But in others, some very natural choices, like if it's the bosons that are hopping, if you were stochastic, now you have this phase, you're very likely ruining stochasticity as you enter this thing. So having symmetry in mind is something we care about, but we were struggling with that, quite frankly, because it seems like we always have to be conscious of the basis we're working in. And this is something we don't want to
do. I see. So you'll say the same thing about, suppose I have some field theory and which has no sign problem, and suppose there's some, I consider action, which is sum over paths, in which, let's say, if there were no topological defects of some kind, action is all real. Let's say there's no sign problem, but then if I put a topological defect, I get some sign contribution corresponding to that topological defect. You might say that even if that happens, it doesn't mean that there is an intrinsic sign problem.
No, it definitely doesn't. And indeed, in most SPTs, topological insulators.
Right, that's what happens. Right.
That's what happens, but we can solve the sign problem there, almost any time.
Right.
And that's how we actually thought about that. I was looking in this model here, and it seemed to be just screaming out that what's the difference here? Well, difference here is the terminal hole conductance, which is related to a geometrical twist, from an anomaly picture. Right. And that got us focused on the geometric thing.
And one last question, maybe very obvious, stupid question. Just if I go to three dimensions, then you have to. You can obviously talk about SNT matrices and maybe more things like various, three loop braiding and so on. Do those things show up when you go to higher dimensions and when you?
They probably do. We sort of lay out some rough sketch of how you might try to prove it, but you should find a geometric manipulation that you can implement in a well-defined, nice, fateful, and sign-free manner. And then if you can squeeze out a phase from that, you're fine. But I won't consider myself an expert in TQFT, let alone like 3D TQFTs, which are like a big jungle for me. But I would guess that, similar principles can be applied, but just a rough guess.
And maybe one very last question. You are doing partition functions on torus and so on. I can also think of, partition function of 2D CFTs, which have similar SNT transformation and so on. So your results also have implication for those 2D one plus 1D CFTs?
Yeah, actually, I had a slide on it, which I thought I deleted. Let me see basically, I think I deleted that, unfortunately, but you have these Coulomb gas models. Some of them are very interesting, C2Fts, and then you have this electrogravitational coupling. And basically you have these electric and magnetic charges in the Coulomb gas, and when you have this background charge, you have a coupling between them. And that seems to coincide with problems that are harder to simulate and interesting. But this is, again, electrogravitational, so it implies some basis-dependent statement with some that. So it's like, I feel like it's a question, related to the question of whether electrogravitational anomalies imply a sign problem, and that's something we wanted to look into but haven't had the chance yet.
I see.
But there is something there that's happening that's also gravitational, even in 1 plus 1 DCFTs. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So some kind of mixed anomaly between some local charge and some lattice, I see.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Very nice talk.
Thanks.
I have a question about the fermion sign problem. Sure. So, is it true that the integer quantum Hall would have an intrinsic fermion sign problem as well?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, yeah, it would.
Right, so then... is there some kind of like distinct computational hardness here?
Great question. So I get that question a lot. And I think only recently I have an answer that I'm happy with. But it's a very good question. So we're basically saying sign problem, computational complexity, but there sits the integer quantum Hall effect as simple as it can be. And it has a sign problem according to our definitions. So here's the thing, when you want to talk about complexity, you don't talk about a specific problem. Okay, so when you talk about complexity classes, say in set three, like this satisfactory problems, there are instances, maybe many instances of the SAT3 problem that are very easy to solve, but that doesn't mean you say that SAT3 is easy. You define complexity with respect to a class of problems that's rich enough sort of to encompass other, to kind of to have all other algorithms being mapped into. So this is exactly the way I look at it now. There is no sense in my mind to talk about a specific model being computationally complex. What I want to talk about is whether a family of model has some computational richness. And that basically removes the integer quantum Hall effect as a fine-tuned point. So the question we conjecture, and I don't know if that's true or not, is when you have an intrinsic sign problem, it means that the phase of matter has interesting computational complexity. The phase of matter meaning a lot of Hamiltonian that are in the same phase have this computational hard behavior. There still could be instances that are exactly solvable, but it's still, I think that should be the analogy. You should talk about a family, like you talk about a family of models for SAT3, you should talk about a family of models. And that's also what you would see in practice because, okay, you find the model for the integer quantum Hall effect, that's not what happens in real life. In real life, you would get a random model. So the more practically interesting question is whether a typical or random model that you get from this phase of matter has a sign problem.
I see, thanks.